Okay. So last year, after completing the book of Genesis, we started on the book of Samuel, 1 Samuel, and the story of David. And I recommend one of two books. Either you can get the David story by Robert Alter, which is a translation and brief commentary of the David story, hence the title, or you can get the complete Tanakh. You will not serve yourself by running into the sanctuary and grabbing the Chumash that is there, because it will not have the text you need. That has the five books of Moses, and that is Genesis through Deuteronomy and the Haftarot, but it does not have the complete book of Samuel. So if you don't have a Bible, this is a good time to get one. The one I recommend is the JPS, because it's readable, but any complete Bible will do. Just know that your translation may be different than the one we're going to use in class. That's the same as this. The only difference between that and this, and you can hold that up, is that that only has the English text. I bring this to class just in case there's some reason to refer to the Hebrew text. Both that and also this are only the English text, but just having the English text is fine. You don't need the Hebrew text. Just that every now and then we might want to look at what the original wording is, so it's good to have. Okay, so we did part of the David story last time, but we will do review this time. I don't even remember, honestly, where we left off. Maybe you do. 18, exactly. Good, 18 is a good place to leave off, but let me just review and make editorial comments about David to bring us either all up to date or to remind us. And as I said last time, not the only reason that I'm doing this, but one of the reasons that I'm doing it is that during the aforementioned sabbatical, I'm going to be writing a book about David for the Yale University Press, which is doing a series of Jewish lives, brief lives, both ancient and modern. Someone just came out, in fact, Vivian Gornick, who's a writer in New York, just came out, for example, with the life of Emma Goldman, the American poet who wrote the poem that's on the Statue of Liberty, right? Give me your tired, your poor. So there are sports figures and so on. And so I'm going to be doing the biography of King David. So obviously I've been reviewing the story and immersing myself in it anyway. Yeah.
I think it was Emma Lazarus.
What did I say? Sorry, Emma Lazarus. The second part of this is that the David story is the most elaborate story of an individual in all of Scripture, and that has, in some ways, the most surprising, for people who don't know it, is the most surprising, because when you read David, all we know about him generally, if we don't know very much, is that he was king and the line of the Messiah comes from David. The longest genealogy in any testament is at the beginning of the New Testament, where the New Testament tries to show that Jesus is from the line of David, because if not, he can't be the Messiah. And so you don't expect David to be an adulterer and a murderer, but in fact, when you read the story, pretty hard to avoid the conclusion that he is. And also, one of the things that we've seen a little bit, but we'll see more, is David's enemies have a convenient habit of being murdered by someone other than David, at least ostensibly other than David, over and over and over and over again. David's always in another place. Always. David, like, has a disposable cell phone. You don't know where, I don't know how it happens, and we'll take a look at it. But it's remarkable that David succeeds to be the king of Israel through this, and yet it is also chock full with religious and Jewish messages. So it's a fascinating amalgam of lots of different kinds of studies and ideas in one story that most people don't ever read. And I have to say that, for my money, it is by far the most interesting story in the Torah, not only because of its length and because of its clear realism, but because of the interplay between David's goodness and badness. You get a feeling of a full-blooded human being in a way that you don't with almost any other biblical character. So that's why we chose the story. Let me give you the background of what we've already read in order to bring us up to date with where we're going now. The book of Samuel starts, which is where it gets its name, with the story of Samuel. There are two books of Samuel, Samuel 1 and 2, but they're divided up for convenience more than for any other reason, just because it was a very long scroll. And you know this from the Torah, that long scrolls are more difficult to manage than short scrolls. And especially that's true, just imagine in the ancient world, if you have to find your place in a scroll, the longer it is, the harder that is to do. So it's divided up into two, and it begins with the story of the birth of Samuel. But let's go back a step just to talk about why it matters that Samuel is born. Israelites come into what is then Canaan, becomes Israel, and they don't have any kind of governmental structure, or they're just a loose confederation of tribes. And they have to figure out how to rule themselves. And you know how hard it is. We actually, you know, somebody should have read the Bible. Look at the Middle East. Yes, you can go into a country, and yes, you can destroy whatever the totalitarian rule is at the time, but then what you get are warring tribes. And warring tribes have a very hard time coalescing and agreeing on a leader. Not easy at all. Instead, what you get is what you have in the Bible, which is shoftim, judges. And in the period of judges, there are these charismatic, basically tribal leaders. Samson is the most famous of them, right? These tribal leaders who, by virtue of personal quality or family connections or whatever else, manage to rise to leadership for a brief time. They win a war, they lose a war, they get knocked off, someone else. And that's why the constant refrain in the book of Judges is, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes, i.e., there was chaos. There was no strong governmental structure. Samuel is the first person who manages to be a generally recognized leader over a long period of time. But he's a religious leader more than a political leader. he's the high priest. But you know from this history of Europe that religious leaders and political leaders are not always so, I mean, was Cardinal Richelieu a political leader or was he a religious leader? Well, he was kind of both. And that happens again and again in European history, certainly, and in Byzantine history, for that matter. And that happens in Israelite history, too. There's always a struggle between religious leadership and political leadership. Samuel, as he gets older, the people demand a king. Samuel doesn't want them to have a king. Lots of reasons why. He thinks a king is against God's will and so on. It also happens to be, since we have a little bit of a cynical undertone in this class, also happens to be against Samuel's interests, if you think about it, because he's the leader of the people and they say, no, we want a political leader, which is going to diminish his authority. But Samuel dutifully anoints Saul as the king. Saul is the first king of Israel and is a failure. Now remember, it's not entirely, I mean, it's complicated in the text, but God tells Samuel to do this. It may surprise you that God does things that don't work out, but not if you read, I mean, first of all, not if you live in the world, but also not if you read the Bible. This happens again and again. Remember the story of Noah, right? God creates a world and then destroys everything. You know, in fact, that's this week's Parsha. And remember, just a little, a tiny little excursus on Noah. You know, when you go into the school, you'll see all these beautiful pictures of arcs and animals going two by two, but we're all adults here. Think about what that story really means, right? Think about killing everyone in the world and every animal in the world except for those who went on the ark. That means women, that means children, that means, you know, for every two elephants that went on the ark, there were lots of them presumably floating on the face of the waters. The story, granted that you don't have to take the story literally, but it's a very violent story, even though the violence is hidden under they went two by two, you know, Noah and his family. But that's a pretty colossal failure of God's to have made this world and then to have to wipe out the entire world. And then after that, things don't go well, and there's Sodom, and on and on and on. Anyway, so God chooses Saul, but Saul turns out not to be the right king. Saul does various things wrong, and then Samuel anoints David. Now, the problem, now that we've come to the story of David, one of the problems with David is that not all the stories about him match up. So, for example, he goes and plays music in the house of Saul to help Saul become undepressed, right? This is sort of the treatment for depression, is David goes and he plays the lyre, which is an ancient form of harp, in Saul's house. And yet then later, when Goliath comes along and they're looking for a champion to fight Goliath, David comes to fight Goliath and Saul doesn't know who he is. It seems as though Samuel anoints David as king, and yet Saul is still king. So there's a lot of snapshots of pictures of the David story that aren't exactly sequential and that are hard to figure out precisely what they mean, but in some way, and we'll see this more as we go along, in some way there is a theme that we will continue to follow. There is a clear struggle between the house of Saul and the house of David for the kingship of Israel. And I say the house because, remember, a king isn't just an isolated figure, right? You know, after the debate, how all the team Romney and Team Obama get on the television and say, this is what the other guy said and this is what we said. Well, yeah, rulers have always had spin doctors, and Saul has his partisans and David has his. Sometimes they're family members, often they're family members, but also they're military retinue, right? The people who travel around with the king and make sure that nobody does him harm. So one of the things that we found, I don't remember exactly where we read to, and we'll take a look in a second, but David ends up marrying Saul's daughter, Michal, and ends up being best friends with Saul's son, Jonathan. Now here again, this is one of those cases where, and we will see this innumerable times, where you wonder, is this just because David happened to fall in love with Saul's daughter? And later in the story, you'll see that that's a questionable assumption, because the one picture we get of their domestic relations is not a happy one. And by the way, is it just that, you know, he was casting around for a best friend, he found this best friend, happened to be Saul's kid? Or again, is this David feeling like, if you're going to take over from Saul, the best thing to do is first of all make sure that his son does not become the king, because Jonathan is the heir apparent, right? He's the one who's supposed to be Saul's heir. He dies in war, by the way, as Saul does. How that happens, again, interesting question. Just happens to be, I mean, sad for David, but convenient. And he's married, as I said, to Saul's daughter, which means that any successor, if she has a child, the successor is now going to be David's successor and not Saul's successor. So it depends how much you like to read between the lines. And in fact, the biographies, and I'll close with this and then we'll go to the videotape. The biographies of David, we have very, very little evidence of the actual historical existence of David, right? And in fact, really we have one inscription from about 200 years after David died that says on it, Beit David, the house of David. So that's pretty firm evidence that there was a house of David, because 200 years later, who's going to invent a king that didn't ever exist? But other than that, we have no firsthand evidence of David. So basically, when you write a biography of David, you can give the context of the time, but you're writing a book about a book, about a story. However, first of all, there's a lot that's told about David that is clearly discreditable, that you'd be crazy to make up about a king of Israel. Who's going to make up the story of Bathsheba, right? That David actually impregnates a married woman and sends her husband off to die, and so commits adultery and murder, right? That's not the way you're going to depict a mythological king who's a founder of Israel. And the fact that so many actions that David takes are recorded but explained in ways that don't cast a bad light on David. So yes, Saul dies, yeah, Jonathan dies, but it's not David's fault. And that's true of other enemies of David. So it seems as though the book was written in some ways to justify things that people might have been upset about, and the very what's called apologetic nature of the book already suggests to scholars that this must be true, because you don't actually have to make excuses for people whose stories you make up, right? You have to make excuses, as we all know, for your kid who really did something in school, but you want to explain that they had a bad night last night and, you know, you got upset at them, and so really the teacher shouldn't blame them because it wasn't their fault, besides it was the other kid. It's like Sam Levinson was a Jewish humorist, and he said when he went to school in kindergarten the first day, his mother sent him with a note to the teacher that said, if Sammy misbehaves, hit the boy next to him, he learns by example. So that's very, you know, that's like the story of David. Okay, so, all right, let's actually start, why don't we start one chapter back. We're going to do it with 17 because we'll read the story of Goliath since it's such a famous story, and those of you who weren't here last year didn't hear it. And we'll read it quickly. We won't make too many comments about it, but it will launch us into the David story. All right, I'm going to read from the Alter translation, but you're free to use any translation you want. Obviously, this is 1 Samuel chapter 17. And the Philistines gathered their camps for battle, and they gathered at Socoh, which is in Judah. Remember, Judah is the southern part of Israel. And they encamped between Socoh and Azek at Ephes Damim. Don't worry about that. And Saul and the men of Israel gathered and encamped in the valley of the Terebinth, and they deployed to do battle against the Philistines. Now remember, doing battle, we're talking about small groups of people, right? A couple hundred on each side, something like that. You're not talking about vast, you know, this is not the throngs of the Lord of the Ring movies. Whatever. The Philistines took their stand on the hill on what, right, I know you got the idea. Well, it's not as though I've actually been in battle, so it's not like my memories of the war, let me put it that way. The Philistines took their stand on the hill on one side, and Israel took its stand on the other side with the ravine between them, okay? And the champion sallied forth from the Philistine camps. Goliath was his name from Gath, and his height was 6 cubits and a span. He was tall. A bronze helmet he had on his head, and in armor of mail he was dressed, and the weight of the armor was 5,000 bronze shekels. In other words, he was big and strong, and he carried a huge bat. And the greaves of bronze were on his legs, and a spear of bronze between his shoulder blades, the shaft of his spear like a weaver's beam, the blade of his spear 600 iron shekels. And his shield bearer went before him. So you get a sense of this is the champion. He has the guy who carries his shield, like, you know, Tiger Woods doesn't carry his own clubs. Goliath doesn't carry his own shield. And he stood and called out to the Israelite lines, and he said to them, why should you come forth to deploy for battle? Am I not the Philistine and your slaves to Saul? Choose you a man and let him come down to me. If he prevail in battle against me and strike me down, we'll be slaves to you. But if I prevail and strike him down, you'll be slaves to us and serve us. In other words, why have a battle and kill everyone? I challenge anybody that you want. And the Philistine said, I'm the one who's insulted the Israelite lines this day. Give me a man and let us do battle together. And Saul heard and all Israel with him these words of the Philistine, and they were dismayed and very frightened. So nobody was willing to go up against him. Okay. And David was the son of the Ephratite man of Bethlehem in Judah named Jesse, and he had 8 sons, and the man in the days of Saul was old, advanced in years. Now, we already know all this, but again, either these are different strands of the story being woven together, or it's what the Bible calls resumptive repetition. In other words, the same thing that they do seriously at the beginning of TV shows. Those of you who don't, this is what happened last week on, you know, I don't know, on New Jersey Housewives with the Stars. And David was the son, okay. And the 3 oldest sons of Jesse went after Saul to the war. And the names of his 3 sons who went to the war were Eliab the firstborn, the secondborn Aminadab, and the 3rd Shammah. And as for David, he was the youngest, and the 3 oldest had gone after Saul. And David would go back and forth from Saul's side to tend his father's flock in Bethlehem. So in other words, he was at Saul's side all the time. So Saul clearly knew him, right? He's at Saul's side. Doesn't even say in Saul's camp. He's at Saul's side. And the Philistine came forward morning and evening and took his stand 40 days. Now, I just want to say 40 in the Bible is a symbolic number, 40 years in the desert, Moses goes 40 days up to the mountain. It's most scholars think 40 days means a long time. Doesn't necessarily mean actually he did this 40 days, but he did it for a long time. And Jesse said to David, his son, take, pray, your brothers this ephah of parched grain and these 10 loaves of bread and rush them to the camp to your brothers. In other words, he's sending him a care package. And these 10 wedges of cheese you'll bring to the captain of the thousand. You'll see if your brothers are well and take their token. That is their shield or their whatever you stamp a letter with. And Saul and they and all the men of Israel in the valley of the Terebinth fighting with the Philistines. David rose early in the morning, left the flock with a keeper, and bore the provisions and went off as Jesse had charged him. And when he came to the staging ground, the army going out to the lines was shouting the battle cry. And Israel and the Philistines deployed line against line. And David left the gear that was on him with the keeper of the gear. And he ran, so he had the provisions that he brought from home. He ran to the lines and asked his brothers if they were well. And he was speaking to them, and look, the champion was coming from the Philistine lines. Goliath the Philistine from Gat was his name. Now we've already been told this. And he spoke words to the same effect, and David heard, and all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were very frightened. Now you could tease out, and some do, two different stories woven together here. You notice that there's not only repetition, but there's stuff that doesn't seem to make sense. Because his father gives him stuff to bring to the brothers, he leaves it with someone and then goes to the brothers. They're calling out battle cries, even though Goliath has already said, instead of having battle, let's just do one-on-one. And 40 days and 40 nights, you can't imagine that all they're doing is standing on opposite sides of the ravine and yelling at each other, right? Oh, what we're going to do to you. But nonetheless, as I said, we're going to somewhat speed through this chapter just to get us up to speed so that 2 weeks from now, when we resume, we'll know where we are. And a man of Israel said, have you seen this man coming up? Why, to insult Israel, he comes up. And the man who strikes him down, the king will enrich with a great fortune, and his daughter he will give him, and his father's household he will make free of the levies in Israel. In other words, he'll give you money, his daughter, and free you from taxes, if there's somebody who can defeat Goliath. Okay? Now, Saul doesn't go up against Goliath himself, either because the king shouldn't fight, because the king is too valuable, you don't want to lose the king, or because Saul isn't up to the task, but he's still looking for a champion from Israel. And David said to the men who were standing with him, what will be done for the man who strikes down yonder the Philistine and takes away the insult from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should insult the battle lines of the living God? Now, here's the interesting thing that I actually don't know if I mentioned last time, but this is the first thing that we hear David say. Now, what is his first sentence? Because you know in literature, usually the first thing that someone says introduces you to his character. Not the first thing he says. What will be done for the man who strikes down this Philistine? The first thing he says actually is, what's in it for the guy who does this? Then, yes, he says God's name. But that's not actually the very first thing he says. And that interplay between, yes, David has this relationship with God, but yes, David is one of those rare kings who becomes king of Israel, puts down rebellion, and dies in his bed, which is not a common fate for kings in the ancient or medieval world. This is the David that we meet at first, right? He gets upset about Israel and the living God, but that's not his first comment isn't, who dares insult the living God and what will be done for the man who goes up against him. It's the reverse, right? And the troops said to him the same effect, thus will be done for the man who strikes him down. And Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the man, and Eliab was incensed with David. Now, why does he get so upset? Maybe he knows David is looking for the main chance. And he said, why is it you've come down, and with whom have you left that bit of flock in the wilderness? I'm the one who knows your impudence and your wicked impulses, for it's to see the battle that you've come. And David said, what have I done? It was only talk, sounding very much like younger brothers from time immemorial. I didn't do anything. And he turned away from him towards someone else and spoke to the same effect, and the troop answered him with the words like the ones before. So he also double checks, right? He wants to make sure that, in fact, this is what's been promised. He doesn't want to take it on the say-so of one guy, which is always a mistake. If you read, did you read the story about the guy who put this show, was going to put the show Rebecca on in New York and got defrauded of millions of dollars? And because he Googled the guy on the internet and he seemed sensible, so he decided to advance him the money, and he didn't do what David did, which is he didn't double check. And he turned away from him. You see, the Torah is always relevant. It's always relevant. And he turned away from him toward someone else who spoke the same truth. And the words David had spoken were heard and told them to Saul, and he fetched him. In other words, now, remember, what words had David spoken? He hadn't said, I'm going to go up against him. He's just asking who's going to do this. So one of two things is going on. Either the Torah doesn't report that David said, by the way, I could pull this off, I could do this, or Saul is so desperate for somebody to go up against Goliath that even hearing someone ask about it has him bring the guy over, right? And David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail him. Your servant will go and do battle with this Philistine. And Saul said to David, you can't go against this Philistine to battle with him, for you're a lad and he's a man of war from his youth. You're a kid. How can you fight against Goliath? And David said to Saul, a shepherd has your servant been for his father with the flock. Now remember, David is supposed to know Saul. He stands next to Saul. He plays music for Saul, and yet he's introducing himself as though he doesn't know him. So the usual explanations are, one, Saul was by this time, we know that Saul had, let's put it this way. He seems bipolar, okay, if you read the whole story. But it's ridiculous to make a medical diagnosis of somebody from thousands of years ago whom you've actually never spoken to and you have like 20 sentences of. But there's something going on with Saul, right? He's not completely sound. So one possibility is he just doesn't remember David. He blanks out, whatever. The second possibility is that these are conflations of different stories interwoven about how David and Saul met. And the third possibility is that there is there's a certain front that Saul has to present in front of his warriors, so is not this boy who comes and plays music for him. We don't know if they would all be aware of that or familiar about that or ask questions about that, so he just acts as though he doesn't know David. Who knows? But anyway, when a lion or a bear would come and carry off a sheep from the herd, I would go after him and strike him down and rescue it from his clutches. And if he'd rise against me, I'd seize his beard and strike him and kill him. Both lion and bear your servant has struck down, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, for he's insulted the battle lines of the living God. And David said, the Lord who has rescued me from the lion and the bear will rescue me from the hand of the Philistine. Now, again, he does the same thing he does at first, which is he says, I can do all this. I've done it before. And by the way, it's God who helps me. But his first comment is, I killed the bear, I killed the lion, and I'll do the same to this guy. And then he mentions how God will help him. And Saul said to David, go, and may the Lord be with you. Now, that seems like one version of the story. But now, again, we go back and have a slightly different version. And Saul clothed David in his old battle garb and put a bronze helmet on his head and clothed him in armor. Now, this is very symbolic because eventually David is going to wear the mantle of the king. He's actually going to supplant Saul. He's going to wear his, his crown, I guess. But he can't wear it now. It's too soon. David girded his sword over his garments, but he was unable to walk, for he was unused to it. And David said to Saul, I can't walk in these, for I'm unused to them. And David removed them. So it's not only that, but there's something comic about it, obviously. Saul's this big guy, we know that, and David's this kid, and he can't walk in Saul's armor. But also, David does things his own way. He actually doesn't want to be Saul's lackey. He wants to go against the Philistine, and since we know what David's battle plan is, we also know that armor's not going to help him, because armor doesn't help you throw a slingshot, whatever. And David removed them, and he took his stick in his hand and chose five smooth stones from the creek and put them in the shepherd's pouch he had, the satchel, and the slingshot was in his hand. He came forward towards the Philistine, and the Philistine was drawing near David. The man bearing the shield before him. And the Philistine looked and saw David, and he despised him, for he was a lad and ruddy with good looks. Now, why the ruddy with good looks? Why? Does the Philistine despise him because he's good looking? No, right? But it's an interesting phenomenon. For most of the heroes of the Bible, we don't have physical descriptions. We don't know what Moses looked like. We have absolutely no idea. There's not a single word that says what Moses looked like. Tall, short, fat, thin, we've no idea, okay? We don't know what Abraham looked like. Here, though, remember, we're in a much more, I don't want to say realistic, the writing is much more, has much more realism to it. It's much more like a novel and much less like myth. In other words, it's much closer to what was true. And we all know, and there are endless studies that confirm this, whether we like it or not, that someone's looks profoundly influence how people react to them. And all through the book of David, we find that David improbably, yeah, he has enemies, sometimes bitter enemies, but again and again and again, he manages to charm people and get his way. So how does he do that? Well, we know that he's successful in war. We know that he's good with words. David is the psalmist. But also, the Torah goes out of its way, I think twice, maybe three times, to tell us that he was good looking. So it at least gives you an opportunity to form an image of David that lets you understand even better why it is that David might succeed, because he has a variety of gifts that would make a king charismatic and successful and all those things. Okay, so, and the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you should come at me with sticks?" Now, we don't know anything about David carrying sticks. Again, he has a slingshot. He doesn't seem to have a stick. So, not clear exactly what this means. Maybe it just means he's referring to Israel. Israel is using this very ineffective tool against him. But nonetheless, and the Philistine cursed David by his gods, that is, by the Philistine gods. The Philistine said, "Come to me, that I may give your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field." And David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with sword and spear and javelin, and I come to you with the name of the Lord of hosts, God of the battle lines of Israel, that you have insulted. This day though shall the Lord give you over into my hand, and I will strike you down and take off your head, and I'll give your corpse and the corpses of the Philistine camp this day to the birds of the heaven and the beasts of the field, and all the earth shall know that Israel has a God. And all the assembly shall know that this is not by sword and by spear that the Lord delivers, for the Lord's is the battle, and he shall give you into his hand." Now, I gotta say, I find this somewhat improbable that David reeled off this speech as Goliath is standing there leaning on his sword, waiting for the guy to finish so he can cut off his head. But you can understand that military speeches are not entirely to be taken, you know, exactly, literally, verbally. They're to gin up the troops to get them excited. So maybe it was an approximation of David's speech. "And it happened as the Philistine arose and was drawing near David, that David hastened and ran out from the lines toward the Philistine." Now it seems as though he's already out there, but, "and he reached his hand to the pouch and took there a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead, and the stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face to the ground." Now, again, you hit somebody in the head, more likely they're going to fall backwards than forwards, but, I mean, makes sense, right? The commentators all note all the things that I've been saying to you. And also, there's a little bit of a problem because in an earlier incarnation, remember, it said that he was wearing a helmet. So it's not so easy to get a stone past a bronze helmet. But here, by the way, depending on who you read, there are discussions about what kind of helmets the ancient Canaanites wore and what kind of helmets were worn in later times, and whether the Philistines wore the kind of helmet that actually could a stone could penetrate, but you'll, whatever, basically. "And David bested the Philistine with sling and stone, and he struck down the Philistine and killed him, and no sword was in David's hand. And David ran up to stood over the Philistine and took the sword from him and pulled it out of his sheath and finished him off and cut off his head with it." Now, by the way, you've noticed he just killed him twice. Because after he hits him with the stone, it says he killed him, and then it says he took the sword and he killed him, right? So It's like the Princess Bride. She's only mostly dead, right? I don't know if you know that. If not, never mind. But right, exactly. So again, if there are different recountings of what happened, and by the way, it would not be at all unusual. It doesn't mean that it didn't happen to say that there are two different stories of what happened, right? All you have to do is think of some legendary happening in your family, and people have different memories of how it happened. And every time you tell the story, people tell it both their ways. So it's not impossible that when this came to be written, you know, half the people remembered it as, no, you know, he was killed by the stone, and the other half said, no, he was still living until his head was cut off. And so both are in there. And the Philistine saw that the warrior was dead. He was, one way or another, you know, he was dead. And they fled. Now, why did they flee? What's that? They don't want to die, right? Well, they flee because, right, first of all, it was Goliath who made the condition, you're going to be the servant of, now, obviously, nobody intends to honor that condition, but also because remember how much the fate of the battle depended on the strength of the god. So that day, the Philistine god was not doing well if a kid beat their most powerful warrior, and you want to come back and fight another day. By the way, yes, it is freezing in here, in case you were wondering. Right, it's not you. Come back and fight another day, and so they run away because it's not a propitious day to fight the Israelites. And the men of Israel and Judah rose and shouted and gave chase to the Philistines until you come to the ravine and the gates of Ekron. And the Philistine dead fell on the way to Shaarim, and as far as Gath and Ekron, they went after them and killed them. And the Israelites came back from pursuing the Philistines and looted their camps. Right? Once they killed them, then they went back and got all their food and their goods and so on. And David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem, but his weapons he put in his tent. Now, he brings the head back to Jerusalem, right, where it's going to be, you know, demonstrated that Goliath is dead, and they killed the great champion. Now, why does he put Goliath's weapons in his tent? I mean, again, if you are somebody who's going to eventually be king, it's good when people come into your office to see your Harvard diploma. That's what it's like. I mean, why do people put diplomas up on the wall? It's like, ooh, you went to Harvard, you know? It's like, oh, you look at, that's a huge spear. How did you get such a big spear? You're not such a big guy. Well, let me tell you the story of how I killed Goliath. So it's not, but the thing is, you, and the reason I pointed out is, I draw the analogy is because as obvious as it would be to us why the diploma is on the wall, to the ancient reader, it would be, I mean, we read it quickly and he put this thing in his tent, but to the ancient reader who only knows from tents after all, it's like David took Goliath's stuff and brought it back to his house. Doesn't give it to Saul, who's the king. It's not Saul's victory, it's David's victory. And so even though we think that it takes a lot to notice it, for most ancient readers, they would notice that right away, just like we would notice the diploma on the wall. And when Saul saw David sallying forth toward the Philistine, he said to Abner the commander, "Whose son is the lad, Abner?" In other words, what's his family? What's his background? I want to know about this kid. And it is possible, although unlikely, that Saul knows him but doesn't know his lineage. But maybe what he's saying to Abner is, Abner is the head of he's his right-hand man. He's what Joab will be later to David. And unsurprisingly later, Joab, that is David's right-hand man, I hate to give a spoiler, but he's going to end up killing Abner much later on. And when we get to that, you'll see that it's basically Abner tries to make peace with David. David seems to make peace with Abner, but Joab doesn't like it, and Joab goes out and kills him. But what might he be saying, Saul, to his right-hand man? He might be saying, find out about this David kid, because I don't like this, you know? It was one thing for him to kill Goliath, but obviously it had consequences far beyond anything that I'm happy with. And when Saul saw David sailing, and Abner said, "By your life, king, I do not know," right? Very safe for Abner not to know who this is, because if he knows who it is, maybe he has some responsibility for bringing him forward. He shouldn't know. And the king said, "Ask you, pray, whose son is the youth?" And when David returned from striking down the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul, the Philistine's head in his hand. Now he's bringing it to Saul, which is what you should do. And Saul said, "Whose son are you, lad?" And David said, "The son of your servant, Jesse the Bethlehemite." Okay, your servant. All right, so that's chapter 17. We have a little time. Are there any questions, comments? Yeah. So, well, the archaeology is complicated. First of all, because it's so, David's, the evidence you would find for David, if you found evidence for David, would be in Jerusalem, which is the most complicated city in the world to dig in. And a lot, in the Muslim section where we think the first temple would, or around the Temple Mount. And also because any digs in Jerusalem are, these days, are very politically charged. A lot of archaeological evidence has been destroyed, some of it deliberately, some of it not by the Israeli government, okay? Some of it deliberately, some of it accidentally, some of it by earlier archaeologists who had bad techniques. They had the techniques of the time, but not good techniques. So, on the other hand, there's a lot of stuff in there from a lot of different. And also, by the way, there, you know, when you come, something like the Cardo. Have you ever gone to the Cardo in Jerusalem? So here's this beautiful street from Roman times, which has two implications. First of all, you got to figure that the Romans leveled whatever was there to build the street. And second, nobody's going to go underneath the Cardo and destroy the Cardo, but the truth is that if you would find David, it would be 1,000 years before. So it's very hard also to just dig where there's life. I would expect that over a long period of time, we'll find more fragments. There are some people who have found homes or buildings that they claim are from the time of David, but other archaeologists dispute it. Over time, hopefully, that will become clearer. There are some people who say that they found homes that were built at the time of Solomon, and other archaeologists dispute it. One thing that seems clear, which archaeology has more or less, in as much as any archaeology can establish anything, because tomorrow you can always find something new. But the picture that I'm giving you is the one that almost all modern historians and archaeologists agree with, which is the kingdoms were very small. I mean, they were really, when we think about David's kingdom, you know, we have this image, David's kingdom, but it was really small, small. And just as Americans have a hard time imagining how tiny Israel is before you go there, and you point to that door and you say, that's Jordan over there, and people are amazed, right, that actually Jordan, you can almost reach out and touch it. It's the same thing here, that battles were hundreds of people. They are sometimes decided 10 on 10 or 50 on 50. And it's like when I say that Joab killed Abner, it would be like, you know, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff killing the head of the Kremlin security. You know, I mean, it's, wars aren't like that anymore. So, yeah. It's, yes, it is certainly possible, although it says he was with Saul, it's certainly possible that this is a way of doing the same thing that the author of Samuel does at the beginning of the book, which is, if you remember, Eli is the high priest, Hannah comes in and she starts praying silently. He thinks she's drunk, and she says, no, I'm not drunk, I'm just, you know, I'm sick at heart. And he says, well, I hope God grants your prayer, and dismisses her and doesn't pay any attention to her, doesn't ask her what she's sick at heart about, nothing. And maybe it's a way of depicting, yeah, David was around Saul all the time, but Saul didn't pay any attention to David because he was king, you know? Yeah. Why does David select five smooth stones and not a jagged one? And the answer, right, and the answer, and why five when he killed it the first strike? Well, the answer is, first of all, you can't be that confident of the first strike. You'll want to have some reserve weaponry. And second is, from what I've read, smooth stones have a more clear trajectory. You can throw them with a better, like jagged ones are less likely to hit the aim being true, and therefore, as a shepherd who's practiced with his slingshot a lot out alone with his sheep with nothing to do, he knows that smooth stones are his best chance. Don. Yes. About right. David is about 1,000 BCE, roughly. Okay, so that means 1,000 years before Roman rabbinic common era times, and it's years before the building of the first temple. It's 300 years before the northern kingdom is destroyed, about 500 years or a little bit less before the southern kingdom is destroyed and the first temple is destroyed. Here's what you have. The warring factions, the north and the south were always different, right? They had different cultures, different, just like in America, right? The north and the south were always had different cultures, different ways of doing things. Under Saul and David, they're one kingdom, the north and the south. They may be different, but they're one kingdom. Saul not so much. Saul actually has not succeeded entirely, but under David, they're one kingdom. Under Solomon, they're one kingdom, but that's it. Under all of Solomon's successors, there's the northern kingdom, which is Israel, and the southern kingdom, which is Judah. So for most of the history, they're two. Greece, it depends what you mean by Greece. I mean, Socrates is much later. Socrates is some 600 years after David. The real revolution in consciousness, what's called the Axial Age, which is when you have the Buddha and you have Isaiah, and when there seems to be sort of a change in world culture, that's about 300, 350 years away still. So we're in a pretty ancient tribal world. It's pre-Socratic, way pre-Socratic, yeah. That's a good question. When is it estimated the book of Samuel was written? So really, it depends who you ask. It's assumed that it's written at least a few hundred years or a couple hundred. Well, here's the hard part is it's not as though the way Bible scholars assume it's written is it's not as though someone sat down one day and wrote the book. It's as though there are stories that circulate. There may even be some written materials that circulate, and they get put together over time. So what you're asking is, when is it finished, as opposed to when is it written? Because scholars assume this about the Bible too, but let's not go there right now, about the Torah, the five books too, but let's not go there right now. But certainly for the book of Samuel, there are probably earlier stories and later stories. There are stories that come from different strands from the northern kingdom, from the southern kingdom. So at least a few hundred years after David dies, it's put together and written. But whether the stories go back to David authentically or not, remember that you live in a culture where when things happen, people tell stories about them. And then they tell stories about this. And most of culture and most of tradition is oral culture. For most of human history, it's oral culture. It's very hard to write things down. I mean, that means incising stuff on stone. Parchment is later, and the earliest, and that's why early written records are so precious and so rare, because it's hard to do in that kind of culture. So, yeah. It's just that the convention was in ancient times that whoever the major character was at the beginning gets the, just like the way we named the Parsha, it's the first major character or difference in wording at the beginning is how you refer to it. Maybe because, since you didn't have title pages, if you open the book and you want to know which book this is, the first thing you run across is Samuel, So you know it's Samuel. If it's called the Book of David, you're going to have to roll for a long time before you finally get to David to make sure it's that book. I'm just guessing that that's why.
Because Samuel is broken up into two books, that might at least say that the second book should have been.
But it just depends how it was organized. Yeah, except that by the time of the second book, the story of David has already started. So it's really a continuation of the previous book, and the previous book is Samuel. So, and maybe it started out as one long, long, long scroll, and someone said, well, let's just break it up and call it Samuel 1 and 2. I don't know how that happened. But remember, the titles, again, they worked differently because the means of conveying information was so different. Yeah. Yes.
Is that before the
Yes. Flood? Yeah, that's already happened.
And does David know that when he goes?
Well, that's another, right? That's another perplexing thing, is that presumably David already knows he's going to be king because Samuel's already anointed him. So there are lots of different ways to read that. One is just these are different stories that are snapshotted together. Another is that David is being very coy. It's hard to know. Because it's clear that David doesn't act like somebody who knows he's going to be king. And neither, by the way, does his older brother. You don't say to the guy who's going to be designated to be king, what are you doing here? Go home, right? And since the coronation or the anointing happens in front of his family, presumably Eliab would know. So it's very perplexing and it doesn't track. Yeah.
Interesting that we also know Joseph is handsome.
Right.
Yes,
right. Well, the Joseph story is clearly one of the patterning stories for David. The younger brother who vaults over older siblings and becomes the ruler, and there are some other similarities, but also the mention of his being attractive, which, as you say, is rare. Yeah, so, yes.
You mentioned that Saul didn't succeed, he failed.
Right. Seems that way. Yes. So why does Saul fail? And maybe we can close with this. The answer is that it's impossible to know whether, I think it's a safe bet that however someone's mind works has something to do with whether they succeed or fail, certainly as a ruler. But Saul, at least according to the story itself, fails. One, because he doesn't follow God's orders to be more ruthless than he wants to be. That is, he doesn't kill Agag, who is the king of the Amalekites, and he's supposed to. And also, it seems as though Saul fails in part because when David comes on the scene, the loyalty of the people shifts to David. So Saul also in part fails because for whatever reason he does not succeed in winning over the heart of the people. And the way the book portrays it is that it's Saul's fault. But you can imagine that in that time, you know, you could build some loyalty among other people that would allow you to be a usurper.
So he gets punished for not being ruthless.
Yes. In essence, he gets punished for not being ruthless enough. He does not kill Agag, and that is what's supposed to lead to the resurgence of the Amalekites and to Haman's, you know, later on, the story of Purim is all really Saul's fault, because Saul could have. And it's where the Talmud says, where the Talmud has a phrase that should be carefully used, but is sometimes true. It says, somebody who is merciful to the cruel will end up being cruel to the merciful. Right? You have to be careful with that one, but it sometimes works. So, yeah. There's no explanation except the youngest. Well, what I said last time was that if you have seven sons, that's the perfect number. So David is the afterthought. And that's, you know, he's the eighth son. You're supposed to have seven sons. Just like in, you know, the Irish tradition, the seventh son of a seventh son. The same thing here. You're supposed to be, you know, an eighth son is an afterthought. So it's that much more. God can make the afterthought into a king. Just like, which is, by the way, because it's patterned on this, like King Arthur, right? Remember? Wart. The kid is he's not an eighth son, but he's the afterthought. He's the little kid who nobody thinks is going to become anything. Okay, so 2 weeks from today, hope to see you here.